Good day, everyone, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm always glad that you've decided to join us today. There is an awful lot going on at the U.S. Supreme Court these days. It's not just the rightward shift that we've seen in recent years, but also a growing scandal of sorts around Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who has been exposed as being awfully close to a very powerful and prominent Republican donor. I wanted to talk about the court today and talk about a number of different things with the court. But first, I want to set the stage just a little bit for what's going on. Of course, throughout his presidency, Donald Trump significantly transformed the court, appointing three really staunch conservative justices and creating a 6-3 conservative majority on the bench, a much larger majority than conservatives have had in recent decades. And these justices have wasted no time providing conservatives with pretty major wins, including the removal of the constitutional protection that women possess to have an abortion in America for almost 50 years. That overturning of Roe v. Wade has been followed by a 3-decade low in public opinion about the court since that ruling. And there are, of course, these other recent revelations about Justice Clarence Thomas and his failure to disclose gifts he received from this billionaire conservative donor for several years. That is not going to help with public opinion, of course, of the court. It is also something that it's unclear what the consequences could or should be. But how do we get to this point where the court has moved so far to the right and has become this kind of lightning rod for public opinion? It is the only branch of government that both receives lifetime appointments and is not directly elected by the people. So what does all of this mean for the future of this still very powerful institution? And what can the public do, if anything, to make sure that there are more checks on the Supreme Court's power? A little later in the show, we are going to be joined by Richard Painter. He's a law professor at the University of Minnesota Law School and former chief White House ethics lawyer who served the George W. Bush administration. He's going to talk about these recent stories about Clarence Thomas and his potential ethics violations. But first, I'm joined by CNN legal analyst Joan Biskupic, who recently wrote a book called 9 Black Robes, Inside the Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences. I should also note that Joan was a colleague of mine of sorts. When I covered the Supreme Court in the mid-2000s, she was the legal analyst for USA Today and Gannett, and I was the court reporter for Knight Ridder. Joan, it is really great to have you here on Detroit Today.
Thanks, Stephen. And as a native of Chicago, I was glad to hear the Detroit weather. Snowy today, 80s tomorrow.
<That's right. laughs>
It takes me right back to the upper Midwest.
That's right.
Anyway,
if you don't like the weather, just wait an hour.
That's right. Right.
It's great to have you here. First, I want to talk, of course, about this book that you have out, 9 Black Robes, How Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences. I want to go back a little to the time when Chief Justice Roberts was being confirmed by the Senate, and there were these great concerns about the court and its direction back then, and the things that he said about the kind of Chief Justice he would be and the way he saw the court and the role of the court. I think about that frequently these days because it seems like it was forever ago in terms of eras of the court. This is an entirely different court, it seems, than the court that Roberts, who is himself a conservative and was appointed because he was a conservative, it just is very different than what he was talking about and from what I think we learned of him during those hearings, the way that he saw his job and the job of the justices.
So much so, Stephen. I think some people in our audience might recall him talking about the role of a justice is like being an umpire. Just, you know, nobody ever came to a game to see the umpire. They're just calling balls and strikes. They're not actually taking a real active role. But, you know, the court he joined had conservatives more like, you know, Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy. They were people who were appointed by Republican presidents who were easily tagged with the label conservative, but were much more centrist and much less predictable than the conservatives we have today. Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy both approved of reproductive rights. They both voted to uphold Roe v. Wade, saying that they, if they had been on the court in 1973, they might not have voted for Roe v. Wade, given that they might not have thought that that was a right in the Constitution. But it was such ingrained in American law that they weren't going to disturb it. They decided to uphold it. Flash forward to the conservatives now, including the three appointees of Donald Trump, who just voted in the summer to end constitutional protection for abortion. And as a reminder of how there's this whole new politically charged atmosphere around the Supreme Court, Donald Trump, when he was running for election in 2016, vowed to appoint only individuals who would vote against Roe v. Wade, and that's what happened. These three justices, combined with Justice Clarence Thomas, who I know you want to talk about, and Justice Samuel Alito, who wrote the opinion overturning Roe, have a as I said, a certain kind of consistency and unyielding nature, and frankly, a sense of urgency to move the court more to the right. Whereas, let's take, for example, Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy, and even Justice Stevens and Justice Souter, both of whom also were on the court that John Roberts joined. Those are two other Republican appointees. They were always searching for more of a middle centrist route, even though Justice Stevens and Souter did end up more to the left. So a very different kind of court in terms of what how it defines conservatism. It's a more active conservatism, certainly. And also in terms of, one other thing I'll add, they are all so much younger. If you think of the relatively young ages of the Trump appointees and the fact that we just don't expect any retirements in the near future, this court that we have today, Stephen, is the court of our future.
Yeah. And it's not just abortion, of course, that we're seeing the court take new kinds of actions on. Spend a little time telling our listeners, though, about the things, the other things that they have done and the other things that may be in the crosshairs for the supermajority that clearly wants to really rewrite, I guess, the jurisprudence that that lower courts adhere to on a number of issues.
Sure, and my book documents the obliteration of voting rights, how they've reined in government regulatory power over the environment and public health, for example, and further blurred the separation of church and state. And then, just looking forward, there are two cases testing affirmative action on campus that are before the justices right now, one from Harvard and one from the University of North Carolina. And I'll tell you, for a lot of your listeners who remember that Michigan was the scene of a really important ruling in 2003 that we call it the Grutter-Bollinger case, that allowed very cautious use of race as one consideration in, you know, the screening of applicants for campus diversity. And that ruling from 2003, based at the University of Michigan case, reaffirmed the principle of the 1978 Bakke ruling that said schools cannot use quotas to when they're screening for students, but they can take into consideration an applicant's race for a diverse student body. And right now the justices are writing those decisions in that pair of cases. They heard arguments late in 2022, and I expect that by June. There's also another case that could further roll back the reach of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and we constantly have cases now coming up involving government regulatory power. And most probably on the minds of the people in your audience who are closely following the court, in the next day, we will hear a preliminary ruling from a preliminary order from the justices on the medication abortion controversy. Mm-hmm. It will be the first case they're taking up since Dobbs, which was the one that reversed Roe. And one last thing I just want to remind everyone of, it at the start of my book, I use a line from the dissenters in that Dobbs mm-hmm. decision that I think plays to the question you just asked me. And what they said was, no one should be confident that this majority is done with its work. And as I say, there is a very strong push, much stronger than John Roberts might have ever imagined back in 2005 when he was confirmed.
Yeah. So I want to go back to Roberts for a second. I mean, he is the Chief Justice, and I think a lot of people think that means he's the boss of the court and of the other justices, and it's, of course, not quite that clear cut. But he is someone who sets a tone of sorts for the court and its leadership. And again, when he was being confirmed, he spoke so eloquently about the things that he holds dear and the things that he respects about the third branch and what it should do. I wonder what role that you see him playing in this new court. There's also, of course, the trouble that he has or has had with the leaking of the Dobbs opinion before it was handed down by the court, something that we never see at the Supreme Court. So it does seem like a place that is challenging his notions of the way it should work. But I guess I wonder what you make of how he might respond to that or what he might even be thinking as all of this unfolds.
Yeah, he's John Roberts is someone who I have known since just about his very first argument before the court when he was a star appellate advocate. He argued for the first time back in January 1981. And that was just about the time I was beginning to cover the court full time. And then you probably remember at the Washington Post, I spent the 90s there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have long watched John Roberts, and then my previous book to this one was specifically on him, The Chief. And this book that, you know, Nine Black Robes really looks at what has happened to his leadership and how a man who was known to be so strategic, tactical, and winning as he was, mm-hmm. is now on the defensive. He's, first of all, he's fighting dissension on his right wing on things like off-bench behavior and ethics. He's wanted to have a formal code of ethics, but that has been a problem. But on the cases, we saw how he wanted more of a compromise ruling out of the Dobbs abortion case. He mm-hmm. was willing to uphold Mississippi's ban on abortion of 15 weeks, but didn't want the court to go further with totally overturning Roe. But as much as he's got a weaker hand now, and I would say that for sure, I would say that there's John Roberts is experiencing a lot of frustration. I want to point out where he is winning and where he still can controls. And one area is on racial remedies. I don't know if he is writing the opinion in the Harvard and University of North Carolina cases, but that has been one area that has been very important to him mm-hmm. to stop, as he says, discriminating on the basis of race, even for benefits for people. And the same thing with religious rights. He has voted for greater protections for religious conservatives and also regulatory authority. So he actually is prevailing more and more, and he still has more in those areas. Not on some culture war areas. He not only lost on abortion rights, but he also famously lost in 2005 mm-hmm. when the justices for the first time declared a right to same-sex marriage. He used his first and only dissent from the bench to protest that ruling. So he's got a bit of a mixed record, but just think of it this way. You're right. You know, as a kid would say, you know, you're not the boss of me. He's not the boss of them. He's not the boss of them. But he still has the assignment power. When he is in the majority, and I can see him voting more on the right side of the court just so he can keep the majorities mm-hmm. and have the power of assignment, which is a really you can then like help shape what the court says, how far it goes in a ruling. He still has the power of assignment there. And he has some authority in the operating of the court, but you know, he can't get around the fact that it takes 9 votes to decide a case. And he, you know, the 3 on the left might help him to try to moderate things, but he still needs a 5th vote. And then in the operations of the court, as we're seeing with these ethical questions, he can't just say, we'll get a 5-4 or 6-3 vote on that. He wants unanimity. You have to have unanimity to say all of us will abide by these kinds of protocols and practices.
Yeah. I'm talking with Joan Biskupic. She is a full-time CNN legal analyst and author. Her new book is called Nine Black Robes, Inside the Supreme Court's Drive to the Right and Its Historic Consequences. We're talking about what's going on at the court, both in terms of the cases that the justices are hearing and ruling on, but also this kind of background story right now about ethics that has unfolded around Justice Clarence Thomas. If you want to join us on the phones, 313-577-1019 is always the number here. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. Joan, I know you do have to run pretty quickly, but I do want to get your take on what we're seeing in these stories about Justice Thomas. You know, I was flabbergasted by them. I know so many judges and have known so many judges for such a long time. I can't imagine a judge who would indulge in this kind of behavior quite the way Thomas did, and then, of course, not report it. But I'm really curious about your response to it.
Yeah, I think Clarence Thomas does need to speak up one way or another. He did answer on the lavish trips, saying he didn't think he needed to record those. But we also now have, you know, very real question about this real estate deal where Harlan Crowe bought pieces of property that the Thomas family owned. And I do think that at a time when the Supreme Court is under such scrutiny for what it does from the bench, that these off-bench activities certainly also diminish the confidence that people have in the court. But as you know, and as John Roberts even says, there is really only one way to get rid of a justice or to punish a justice in any real effective way, and that is through the impeachment and conviction process that we had, that we have for the President of the United States. Mm-hmm. And no justice has ever been removed from office that way. So, you know, I have covered so many of these situations where a justice's ethics have been called into question. This one involving his trips that ProPublica documented on Harlan Crowe's, you know, private jet and super yacht to really wonderful places across the globe just gets everybody's attention more than these other instances. But frankly, Stephen, I have seen them fade, and I think that might be what some of the members of the court are hoping for, is that this just fades. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I do have to run because the court is hearing cases this morning right at 10, but thank you so much for your time. I enjoyed it.
No, thank you. It's great to hear from you, and congratulations on the book. Thanks so much to Joan Biskupic for being here with us. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, take a little deeper look into the ethics troubles that have reared their head at the court. Richard Painter, a law professor at the University of Minnesota Law School and former chief White House ethics lawyer during the George W. Bush administration, is going to join us. Also want to get going with you on the phones and on Twitter. 313-577-1019 is the number. You can go to Twitter and hashtag us as well. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. You just heard Joan Biskupic, the legal analyst for CNN, talk about the fact that she believes that because there aren't really a lot of consequences for Supreme Court justices who go beyond the scope of ethical behavior, that she thinks the recent scandal surrounding Justice Clarence Thomas might very well just fade. Is that what's going to happen, or might this inspire a real look at the ethics that govern the third branch of government in Washington and maybe inspire some change? That's where we want to continue the conversation here on Detroit Today. We've got another voice to add to the conversation. Richard Painter is a law professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. He also was the chief White House ethics lawyer during the George W. Bush administration. Richard, welcome to Detroit Today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I want to start with what Joan Biskupic was just saying, this idea that that there isn't much that can be done about ethical breaches in judicial behavior, and that maybe this will just go away. And in fact, she said that this may be what the justices are counting on, that there won't be further inquiry or pressure on Congress to maybe change that. I wonder what you make of that assessment of the situation and the likelihood of change.
Well, perhaps it will fade away, but it need not. And we've been here before. It was 54 years ago in 1969, mm-hmm. When Justice A. Fortas, who had been nominated previously by President Johnson to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But 1969, during the Nixon administration, Abe Fortas was exposed for having taken money from Louis Wolfson, a financier, who had some serious legal difficulties. And Fortas actually returned the money as soon as Louis Wolfson was indicted. Justice Fortas did not participate in any case involving Louis Wolfson. It was a consulting contract. And even though he'd returned the money, had no conflict of interest, he was forced off the court. Mm-hmm. He was not impeached. But both Republicans and Democrats in Congress made it clear that impeachment might very well be an option. And Chief Justice Earl Warren put a pressure on Abe Fortas to resign. The Democrats did not rally to his defense, even though they knew that President Nixon would get an additional appointment on the court. Mm-hmm. And Nixon indeed tried to put an arch conservative on that seat and failed because the Senate wouldn't support him. And Justice Blackmun took the seat instead. But the point is that the court previously has dealt with this and has been willing to stand up for ethical principles. And I'd have to say that what Justice Fortas did, well, it was very, very concerning, was not as serious as what we're confronting here. Mm. This is a longstanding relationship with a billionaire, with a failure to report these gifts and other transactions pursuant to the Ethics in Government Act of 1978. Justice Fortas was before the Ethics in Government Act. We tolerated less transparency on the court than we supposedly do now in the post-Watergate era. The law is clear, but we're not enforcing the law. And the justices are going to interpret the law for the rest of us. I would think that they could themselves comply with the law. And they're not, mm-hmm. if they tolerate this among their colleagues.
So I want to go back to something you just said, the comparison between what Abe Fortas did and what Clarence Thomas is now being questioned about. I go through the things that you see as problematic here, because I'm not sure that most people, when they think of the Supreme Court, understand the kinds of distance that members of the judiciary are expected to keep from big donors. And I think also there's a real distinction between this question about taking trips on a yacht or on a plane and the real estate transactions that were revealed last week. They fit into different kinds of ethical categories, I think.
Well, they do. But the common theme here was the requirement to disclose, a clear legal requirement in the Ethics in Government Act of 1978. And after the Nixon era, after the episode with Justice Fortas, Congress changed the law and they made it clear that these types of gifts, transactions, must be reported. And then There can be scrutiny as to what is allowed and what is not allowed and what types of conflicts of interest arise. But as Justice Louis Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And Congress chose a disclosure regime in 1978 in the Ethics in Government Act for all three branches of government. Members of Congress must file these reports. The President of the United States must file these reports. I filed disclosure reports when I was in the White House, and the senior White House staff filed those as well, and the judiciary. The law is a law. It must be complied with. And I see that it is not. And with respect to both the gifts of jet travel and yachts and also the real estate transactions, they needed to be disclosed, and they weren't.
I'm talking with Richard Painter. He's a former White House ethics lawyer, chief White House ethics lawyer during the administration of George W. Bush. He's a law professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. We're talking about the questions that have been raised about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and his close association with a billionaire Republican donor. Those stories in ProPublica over the last couple of weeks really raise questions about not just the behavior that justices are expected to adhere to, but also what happens when they don't. What are the consequences? What could they be? We want to hear from you as well during the conversation. Give us a call and let us know what you think about Justice Thomas. Do you think he has violated ethics rules by failing to report these free expensive trips he received or the property that he sold to a Republican donor? What would you like to see change, perhaps, about the way in which we handle these things in this country? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation that way. Let's start today with Ed in Detroit. Ed, welcome to the show.
It's amazing how a man who calls himself an originalist and a textualist can't read text. I wanted to make a historical comment. Mm-hmm. People in the 20s, 30s, and 40s will be confronted with a court that is analogous to the court Franklin Roosevelt dealt with in the 1930s. He had judges who were from the Victorian, late Victorian, and Edwardian era who were out of step with the changes that had taken place in the country. We're going to go through that again with a bunch of judges educated in the 20th century who may not be able to adapt to the changes of the early 21st century. I wonder whether your guest has any comments on either the textualist issue or the historic issue.
Yeah, Ed, I really appreciate the call and the great questions. Richard Painter, go ahead.
Well, yes, a lot of the originalist interpretation of the Constitution isn't originalist at all. It's a substitution of the views of some law and economics scholar from the University of Chicago or some unitary executive theorist who supports an expansive presidential power. It's substitution of these novel academic theories for the intent of the framers. And there's been too little pushback on that, particularly when progressives seem to want to distance themselves from the framers because of the very tragic and immoral decisions were made about slavery. Mm-hmm. But there are many things the framers got right, and abandoning the intent of the framers' interpretation of the Constitution to the academic theorists of the right is a very, very bad idea. And that's what we're seeing in some of this jurisprudence. I would have to say that for a number of reasons, I'd probably take the Supreme Court of the 1930s over this one. although I think that President Roosevelt's response to that was certainly within what the Constitution permits, which if the president has the votes in Congress to expand the court, the president can do that with the support of the House and the Senate. We're not in a position where that can be done right now, but that may come in the future. Right now, we need to focus on the ethics and the lack of ethics, which I think is we have a serious problem. Mm-hmm. On the Supreme Court and in some of our other courts with respect to judicial ethics. Lifetime tenure should not come with a lack of accountability to the country and to the public.
And so Justice Thomas says, one of the things he says is that he was advised by other justices that accepting these gifts was not a rules violation. And that may concern me at least as much as the fact that he did it. If that's true, that other justices said, hey, don't worry about it. It seems that we might have a much bigger problem with justices and their behavior. But again, because it's self-policing, it suggests that there is very little that might ultimately be done. I mean, where would the pressure come from, if not within the court, for them to do this differently?
Well, this is a problem. It's the phenomenon of colleagues covering for colleagues. We see it in police departments where officers will ignore the brutality and racial profiling by other officers. We see it in academic departments. There's a lawsuit pending now against the University of Michigan Law School about really kinky emails sent to a professor by a dean. Mm-hmm. All the faculty looks the other way. And now we see this at the Supreme Court of the United States. Colleagues covering for colleagues. It's very, very corrosive for ethics and for democracy. And once again, if you combine it with lifetime tenure, whether for a university professor or even worse, a Supreme Court justice, we have lack of accountability and people who can serve for decades in their positions interpreting the law for the rest of us, but not following the law.
Yeah.
A very, very bad situation.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Richard Painter, University of Minnesota law professor, about judicial ethics. Also want to continue to hear from you on the phones and on social. Give us a call. Let us know what you make of Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, violating ethics rules by failing to report free expensive trips he received and not reporting property transactions with a very prominent Republican donor. Give us a call. 313-577-1019 is the number. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your place for open dialogue.
The music you love.
Real news and in-depth analysis.
And cultural experiences. The sound of Detroit.
101.9 WDET is your public radio station.
Okay, for a member of our federal judiciary, a Supreme Court justice, to be friends with a powerful Republican donor, to take gifts from that donor and not report them. That's what we're talking about here on Detroit Today. I'm Stephen Henderson, and always glad that you have joined. Our guest is Richard Painter. He is a former chief White House ethics lawyer during the administration of George W. Bush. Also is now a law professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. We're talking about the stories about Justice Clarence Thomas and his relationship with a prominent Republican donor. The things that he did, are they okay? The lack of reporting of those things, is that okay? And if not, how do you make sure that he does things differently? 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. If you want to join the conversation, that's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. Richard, I want to talk about Chief Justice John Roberts and the role that you see him playing here. You talked earlier about Chief Justice Earl Warren and how he went to Justice Abe Fortas when he was caught in an ethical quagmire and convinced him to leave the court. Chief Justice Roberts, of course, is very different than Chief Justice Warren. The court is a very different place now than it was in the late 1960s. But what do you imagine is the role Chief Justice Roberts should be playing right now in dealing with this ethical breach?
Well, the first step is a full investigation of what happened. And Chief Justice Roberts ordered an investigation of the leak of the abortion opinion. That investigation lasted for months. I think that was the right thing to do. There should not be leaks from the court. But this is a much more serious situation than a leak of an opinion a month or two before the opinion is released. This was an actual violation of the Ethics in Government Act of 1978. Certainly appears to be based on the facts as I understand them. The Chief Justice should have an investigation, take a look at all of these transactions. Justice Thomas should share his tax returns with the Chief Justice so they can compare what was reported to the IRS with respect to particularly the real estate transaction with the disclosure reports and also make a determination as to whether the law was violated. If the law was violated, which it appears to have been, the next question is whether it was unintentionally or negligently. In either case, there's serious questions as to whether Justice Thomas should continue to serve on the court if he can't comply with the law himself. If it was intentional omission, it's a much more serious situation because then that would be intentionally lying on a federal filing, which could be a felony if, once again, you know you're lying and you lie. But we aren't there yet, and this needs to be investigated fully. I'd have to say that Justice Thomas's interpretation of the Ethics in Government Act is just flat out wrong. There is an exception for personal hospitality from a close friend, but that is limited to food, lodging, and entertainment, staying at someone's house for the weekend, going to someone's house for dinner, a concert at that person's house, not where they buy you tickets, that type of thing. It does not cover transportation. That is not in the exception for personal hospitality. So we don't have personal hospitality on someone's private jet or yacht that does not have to be disclosed. And I advise the White House staff on the Ethics in Government Act and the same thing. I don't care how close the personal friend is. If they fly you on their jet or they take you on their yacht and transportation, that is not covered the exception. It must be disclosed. And then we have the conversation about whether you should have accepted the gift to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that didn't happen here. And I find that if the justice is going to interpret federal statutes in such a convoluted manner, when they apply to himself, I question whether he is able to interpret those statutes and the United States Constitution in cases that are binding on the rest of the American people.
Yeah, yeah. I also think that it's worth at least pondering at this point the motivation for these kinds of gifts. I mean, Clarence Thomas says he is a friend of Harlan Crowe's. Harlan Crowe says he's a friend of Justice Thomas. But these outsized kinds of financial dimensions of the relationship certainly must raise the question about the buying of influence. Harlan Crowe is somebody who has real aims as it regards, the Supreme Court and the cases it hears and the judgment that it renders. I wonder if you think this raises in some prosecutors' minds, perhaps, a question about why these gifts were given, why these deals were made, and whether there is some sort of expectation of a quid pro quo or perhaps an actual one.
Well, this is a question I dealt with as well when I was in the White House with the White House staff and the cabinet members in the ethics briefings. There is a personal friend exception to the gift rules allows you to accept certain gifts from personal friends, although they do need to be reported. Mm-hmm. And one of the points I made is that it's amazing how as soon as you get a job in the White House, all sorts of new personal friends emerge out of nowhere.
Right.
you can't go anywhere, to a party or to church or anywhere. Everyone sort of wants to be your personal friend. And that needs to be viewed with some skepticism about what the objectives are. I was personally lobbied by a lobbyist in the swimming pool at the Chevy Chase Club in Chevy Chase, Maryland, when I was in the White House, and I watched the same lobbyist lobbying the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission. It's amazing what goes on in Washington and what friendships are all about. And imagine what happens if you get a lifetime appointment to the United States Supreme Court, how many personal friends or billionaires will emerge out of nowhere. This is very, very troubling. How to control it is difficult, much more difficult question. But the one decision Congress made in 1978, the Ethics in Government Act, is that we must have transparency. The gifts must be reported, and that includes the private plane flights and the yacht trips. And, of course, the real estate transactions, all of that needs to be reported. So at least we know what's going on. And parties with cases before the court know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number. Big Neo on Twitter says, keep a check on SCOTUS and all elected officials by making a requirement that all of their on-duty meetings, briefings, and phone calls are recorded and posted for public legal review. Accountability is needed. Obviously, an exemption should be made for classified material. That's not a terribly practical idea with regard to the way the court operates, Richard. Most of what the court does is in secret, but this idea of better transparency bumps up against that in some cases. I wonder if you have concerns about that get into the way in which the justices deliberate, given that there is this possibility of relationships with people like Harlan Crow that could be influencing, I suppose, those deliberations.
It's a very serious problem. Finding the solution is the difficulty. Mm-hmm. A lot of the discussions here that influence the court are off-duty. Mm-hmm. While lying on a yacht somewhere in the Caribbean, fully paid for by a billionaire, I'm not sure that the conversations between the justice and the billionaire are limited to the latest sports scores. Subject matter of pending cases might come up. We have no idea what's going on that yacht, what's being discussed, why the billionaire is such a close friend of the justice, and so forth. It's a very challenging situation. The least we could do is have the transparency rules so that everybody knows what's going on. And Justice Thomas apparently did disclose some travel back in the early 2000s and got some criticism for it, which is how the system's supposed to work, where they say, well, you're getting too close to that billionaire and so forth. So he just decided to stop disclosing, I guess. And that's very problematic. So, yes, we've got a serious problem. Don't know what we could do about it. Yeah. I don't think it's necessarily the on-duty communications that are taking place while they're in the courthouse or during the working day that are the biggest problem. It's what's going on the weekends, sitting on the yacht or wherever they are, vacationing with the rich and famous while ignoring the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Susan in Huntington Woods. Susan, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I formerly worked with the federal government in a far less influential position. And one thing that still strikes me that I think the speaker right now is emphasizing is that there's no, whether or not what the justice did was right or wrong, there's no question you're supposed to report these types of activities. Even the appearance of some kind of conflict of interest is something to report. And you can go about your business. But as well, like context matters as well. You report these kinds of possible these activities, and context can change. And that also matters.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I guess I'm just surprised that anyone would question you aren't supposed to report something like these activities.
Susan, I'm glad you called because, you know, as you say, even at much lower levels, so to speak, of government, these are obvious rules, and people observe them without much thought or question. And so, Richard, that kind of raises, I guess, suspicions about whether this was intentional or not. The idea that Justice Thomas did not know, for instance, that these things were supposed to be reported, or that some of the things he was doing were themselves beyond the bounds of ethical behavior themselves.
Well, yes, it's very, very troubling. I mean, transparency is critical because once we know what's going on, at least part of what's going on, we'll never know what was discussed on the yacht. We can think about what could be done about it. There also might be indirect social pressure put on the justice to recuse from certain cases and so forth, knowing that the relationship between himself and the billionaire is somewhat, at least in the public eye. Without transparency, we're helpless to deal with this. And that was the point of the Ethics in Government Act of 1978. One of the things that's really troubling is that Justice Thomas, without naming names, says he consulted his colleagues. He said it's okay. And I want to know who these colleagues are and whether that actually happened. Or is this just one more example of colleagues covering for colleagues, which, as I say, I've seen in academic departments with tenured professors. You see it in police forces, colleagues covering for colleagues. But when we're talking about the Supreme Court of the United States and its enormous influence over our lives and interpretation of our Constitution and statutes, we really can't have this continue. The court is going to lose its credibility very quickly with American people if it doesn't confront this problem.
Susan, really appreciate the call and that really valuable perspective. Let's go next to Robert in Detroit. Robert, what's on your mind?
Hey, I think that the court lost its credibility a while ago, and Clarence Thomas is one of the people who came in under a cloud of unethical behavior, but there have been many others since then. I'd like to see the court, not progressive, not conservative, but just like Robert said, call the shots. And I think part of the problem is how they're selected through the Congress. I mean, we've seen, the American public has seen that these people up for nomination lie under oath, and then we get Citizens United that says money is speech. Mm-hmm. So it's like, how do we resolve this? I'd like to see a larger court right now that's a little bit more neutral, and I'd like to see the Senate take their role more seriously before they even get on the court.
Robert, those are interesting observations and ideas, and I think there's a lot of the American public that agrees. Richard, go ahead and respond to the idea that maybe part of the problem is the way that we select and vet the people who end up with these lifetime appointments.
Well, it's a very partisan process. It has nothing to do with the merits, although I would say that the justices are certainly, most of them, you know, very well versed in the law and very capable, very intelligent, but are the people who rise to that level better lawyers, better judges than those who do not? Of course not. It's all politics. The selection process inside the White House in both Democratic and Republican administrations. The problem is that in the confirmation process, it's highly partisan. And what's amazing is that if Congress wants to pass a bill through the Senate to reform the healthcare system or anything that is by way of the statute, they need to get through two-thirds of the Senate. And two-thirds of the senators can block the legislation, as President Biden found out a year ago. But for the appointment of a justice of the Supreme Court, apparently a bare majority will do it. And Donald Trump put three justices on by a bare majority. And other presidents, both Democratic and Republican, have put justices on the court by a bare majority of the Senate. And while I don't support the filibuster, I do think that if someone can't get the vote of 60 senators, at least they probably should not be on the federal courts. We don't need the the far left and the far right jostling for position to put their favorite candidates on the court. But we have to confront the fact that in both political parties, the political base would like to see people put on the courts who would squeak by a bare majority of the United States Senate. Yeah. And so there is very little willingness in either political party to support a supermajority requirement and to say, well, you know, for interpreting the Constitution for a lifetime appointment, if you can't get 60 senators, you really shouldn't be one of the nine.
Right.
And I think we should think seriously about whether that would be the better approach.
Okay. Richard Painter, it was really great to have you here for this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
It's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when we're going to sit down with Wayne County Health Director Dr. Abdul El Sayed to discuss the state of health outcomes in Wayne County and what needs to happen to improve results in our area. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.